You're listening to Focus on Utilities, brought to you by Power and Utilities Australia, the disruptor platform for Australia's utilities undergoing transition. Join us each month as we bring together diverse and divergent voices from the energy sector to unpack some of the key challenges and opportunities facing energy networks as they transition towards net zero. It's a big week as we celebrate International Women's Day, and so we thought we'd do something special with the podcast to acknowledge the powerful women who play such an important role in Australia's energy industry. Taking the reins today is our friend of the show, Bronwyn See, who is joined by a panel of some of the incredible contributors to our Power and Utilities Australia Advisory Board to discuss the five trends for 2024 in an evolving energy workforce. On this International Women's Day, I think it's worth acknowledging the enormous work still to be done by Australia's utilities industry in recruiting, recognising, empowering and rewarding women. The recent Workplace Gender Equality Agency report rates this industry as the third lowest in terms of gender equity, with women making up only 26% of the workforce and only 28% of key management positions, whilst the mean gender pay gap sits at 20.1%. rating this industry sixth highest out of 19 industries. Let's just let that sit for a moment. It's easy to focus on problems. And what I love about today's guests is that they are focused on solutions. I've no doubt that this session is going to be a cracker, and Bronwyn, who better to rip off the Band-Aid than you?
Thanks, Paul. Now here today, we've got a special episode for International Women's Day, and Focus on Utilities have decided to call it Five Trends in Workforce Inclusion in Energy and Beyond. But I'm calling it Five Workplace Trends We All Need to Keep on Top of for 2024. And I have three unbelievably super women with me to have a chat about these workforce trends. And so I might just kick off to introduce them at the moment. The first one is Vanessa Ong, who is a renewable energy project acquisition and development expert. She brings two decades of diverse leadership experience in the energy sector, and she specialises in those mysterious areas of corporate development, strategic business operations and executive leadership. Thanks for being here, Vanessa.
Thank you. Thanks, Bronwyn. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but thank you.
Well, we're all expert in something these days. The next one is Rosemary Calm, who is comes to us with 20 plus years of strategy and operational experience in infrastructure, telecommunication and power generation. Her areas of expertise really revolve around customer strategy, insights and marketing. And she recently led a lot of planning for the NBN, for the NBN network, and to optimise its technology mix. So I wonder how she's really still standing. That seems like a really big job. So welcome, Rosemary. We also don't say that she is also a very senior strategy consultant from McKinsey. So I don't think she advertises that, but certainly she has a fantastic reputation in the management consulting space. So welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you, Bronwyn. Very happy to be here and looking forward to the conversation.
And then finally, we have Aki Sharma. Aki has 10 years in the energy industry across both the UK and Australia, and she brings a wealth of expertise in technology and business strategy. And she has a great passion. She tells us that she's passionate about clean energy and digital transformation that drives the energy transition. So she's right in the hot spot of the energy transition, as we see. So Aki is at Schneider Electric and is a segment director for Power and Grid. So thanks for taking your time out today, Aki, to join us.
Thanks for having me, Bronwyn. Really excited to be here and looking forward to the chat this afternoon.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great one. It'll be quite informal and you get to hear all sorts of perspectives around what is inclusion and what is our workforce doing. And I think some you'll say, oh, not again. And others you'll go, yep, that's a bit of a curveball. So let's see how we go. And I'd love to see the comments. Please feel free to put comments. And also to, as my seven-year-old says, like and subscribe, like and subscribe. Anyway. So I was having a bit of a think, and it's like, well, what's gone on in the last couple of years in the energy industry? And we're so used to so much happening. But when you take a bit of a look back, you know, COVID was only 3-4 years ago, if you can believe it, and it's really disrupted how we see our industry. We saw lots of layoffs internationally. And then after that, we got a global energy crisis. We had all sorts of geopolitical changes. We saw lots of uncertainty. And then we started to see supply chain disruption, tight labour markets, extraordinary interest rates, changes to how we're seeing investments both in traditional models and also in sustainability. And so what we're seeing is these rapid changes and rapid changes in investment. And what we also saw, so the IEA tells me, is that more people work in the clean energy sector today than work in the traditional energy sectors that revolve around fossil fuels. And I think this sort of reflects how much we will see this change come through. The statistics are quite interesting. So the energy employment reached 67 million in 2022, and that's over 3.4 million over pre-pandemic levels. Clean energy stood at 35 million, while fossil fuel jobs recovered slowly after the layoffs of 2020, but still remain at about 32 million. What we're seeing is a rapid growth in five sectors, which are solar PV, wind, electric vehicles, and battery manufacturing, as well as heat pumps and critical mineral mining. But what we're also seeing is a lot of our workforce is looking to change. So a recent statistic that came out near the end of last year was 91% of power professionals would consider changing their roles within the next 12 months, with 54% highlighting an interest in the area of renewables. So I think what we're seeing is this tightening market, lots of changes, but also a workforce that's ready to transition. So, and I think that's reflected in the trends we're going to see. So shall we kick off with the first one? What do you reckon? Okay, the first one is hybrid working and flexible working are here to stay for 2024 at least. We'll see employers create new types of benefits to address the costs of coming to work. So it won't be just an email from the CEO saying, could you please, on my knees, ask you to come to work at least 2 days a week. What we'll start to see is some really creative benefits for people to come back into the office. And what we've actually seen is that the hybrid workers or the flexible workers are coming back, but they're coming back slower and in different ways. So a recent report saw that hybrid workers are coming into the office generally 2.6 days per week in the energy industry, ones that can work remotely. The biggest change is we have more coming in 3 days a week and fewer occupying the 1 to 4 days on site per week. So it's sort of, I would call it smushing in the middle. So what we're trying to see is how are those hybrid workers finding their way? Are they being required to do certain days? And how is that flexibility helping balance work, life, and family? And I think, Rosemary, you've worked quite flexibly over the years.
Yes, absolutely, Brenwyn. So what's the thing that you did not say in the introduction is I'm also a mother of two young boys that are now 8 and 9, and I've been indeed on some form of part-time flexible working arrangement since 2014. And as we sit here, you know, a few days ahead of International Women's Day, I just would like to take maybe some time to acknowledge that the conversation that we're having today is radically different than the conversation that was happening, of course, 10 years ago, but even 5 years ago. So when I came back from my first mat leave and I started to operate on a part-time basis, I would not say that I was the exception, but I was clearly a minority. fast forward to today, and yes, COVID has been extremely challenging time, but the gift that we had is that it put flexibility as a mainstream conversation. I think it's not anymore a minority conversation. It's a mainstream one. And also the thing that I find quite extraordinary is that it's less gender-based. So again, 10 years ago for me, the question of being part-time or on flexible working arrangement was mainly a female topic for conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that all these flexible working, you know, consideration, policies, arrangements are now putting, you know, as a gender a bit out of this equation. I'm not saying that there is not a gender part of this equation, because I think that maybe as a mother, and that's just my personal view, I have a deep, deep need for flexibility. But I think it has really, really changed the game. And I would like to acknowledge that.
I call flexible working flexible yoga, in that rather than doing sort of like trying to get myself into the right position, I end up doing a downward dog and fall over and end up in the fetal position crying. So flexible working has been quite difficult for me, but I do hear of areas where it has worked well. Aki, have you found it working well for you, and what were those areas that you had to put routines or standards in place to make it work well?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with everything that Rosemary's just said about the fact that flexible working is almost, it's normal practice now, right? And thanks to COVID, whether we talk about the conversation on flexibility or digital transformation, everything was enabled during the pandemic, and we've come so far over the last 5 years. So if I speak of my own experience, I have two very young kids. So I've got two under five at the moment, which is a very interesting balance. So for me, flexibility is absolutely essential, especially as young parents. You know, you're doing the drop-offs in the morning, the pickups in the afternoon, and then managing meetings and calls and still deliverables that you have to commit to as a leader or as a part of your job, working around how you're going to manage that with family commitments, etc. So for me, quite like Rosemary, flexibility has been almost a necessity as I've come back after kids. The only thing I think one of the things that I'm conscious of, and this is something that I think of even as we're looking at building, attracting talent within the energy sector for the future, and as well as how do we retain, how do we make it a good experience for everyone. One of the things I think about often is, with the growth that we're seeing in the clean energy sector and the huge opportunity that's ahead of us in terms of the energy transition, how do we make sure that flexible work practices don't turn into burnout for people, right? With flexibility often comes, not the need, but there is an element of staying on more than you probably would if you were only coming into the office, perhaps. And with so much opportunity and excitement that's happening within the energy sector, there is so much for us to do. And if you're passionate about it, you are committed to making a difference and you are committed to your role. But how do we make sure that talent that we're attracting, but also people that are within the sector today, flexibility is great, but I think the flip side of flexibility, it can also be, leading to overwhelm, burnout, if we're not careful.
And it is one of the leading causes they're seeing of burnout now, is being always on. So that flexibility and the ability for technology to assist us to be flexible has also meant that there's a 24/7 culture, and burnout is happening because you just don't turn off from work. Is that something you also felt, Rosemary?
Yeah, well, I would like to maybe build on what you were saying, Aki, because I think that when we talk about, working from home, working from anywhere, return to the office, I think the benefits are very tangible. and very easy to explain. So you save time in commute, you can pick up the kids, you can care for whoever you need to care, you can have the flexibility that you need to do to meet your job requirements and your broader, you know, requirements. So all this is very, very easy to discuss, right? What I find that is less tangible and maybe less discussed is a shadow side of that flexibility, and there is a shadow side. And I would say for me, there are a number of them. One is around exactly what you were saying, the always on. And to some extent, when you go to the office, there is a moment that you are getting into the space of work. And when you leave the office, there is a moment where you leave that space, which is a workspace, and you enter your private space. And I think one of these flip side of flexibility is actually being able to manage the blurring of the lines between what is your personal space and what is your professional space. And the other thing that I think is a bit of a danger, and I don't hear a lot of people talking about it, is that when people are working extensively from home, it's super convenient. But then we end up spending our days behind screen and we don't have this face-to-face interaction, this human connection. Absolutely. Now, the benefits of actually tangible human connection, they're harder to quantify and to feel. You don't feel, you feel the pain, if I could say it like this, of commuting every day. You don't feel the pain every day of not seeing someone in the flesh. But I believe that over, you know, months and weeks and years, if you don't have this kind of flexible arrangement in a true flexible sense of the term, being having a good balance, then I'm not so sure this is good for mental health, right? And so for me, when I think about all this workplace flexibility, I think it has to do with balance. And having a lot of balance in terms of what we are doing, balance between time at home, balance with time at the office, balance between keeping and protecting your personal space. And I think the balance is hard to find, to be honest.
Or lack of balance in, as in my world, where I've stopped trying for the utopian vision of balance and gone with maybe a small boundary or two. But I think this is a really good portion for us to really think about the next topic, which is around DEI and diversity and inclusion. And, you know, we really saw this come to the fore in 2020, but we've also seen it sort of slip by and there's been a growing disillusionment with DEI and potentially some pushback. But what we are hoping to see, and I think we will, is that DEI is not going to disappear. In fact, it'll be probably become more embedded in the way we work. And we've seen that so far in how we've seen executive remuneration and how that's been linked to DEI. But there's so much more that to DEI than executive remuneration and how that's going to work. I think, Aki, you had some really great comments on this one.
Yeah, so DEI for me is such an interesting space. And you're right, Bronwyn, that over the last few years, if we even look at over the last 4 years, I think about around, so statistics will show us around 2020, the roles within DEI really skyrocketed. But then over the COVID period, and as we started going through almost a global economic downturn, we started seeing a lot of those DEI roles move away. In fact, there was a report that I was reading recently that looked at about 500,000 C-suite hirings globally between 2019 and 2022, and it showed that the hiring of the chief diversity officers actually declined in 2022. And I thought that was a really interesting stat because the CDOs or the chief diversity officers were really the only C-suite position that experienced a decline in 2022. So it was quite telling. And I think what often happens is when you're going through times of economic downturn or when there's a huge focus on cost and efficiencies, your first roles that are looked at in terms of, how do I say, cost cutting, if you will, tend to be often, you know, your D&I space, often even talent acquisition. But as we come away, or even during the pandemic times, as we look forward to working flexibly, working effectively, working through digital tools, and having more of an inclusive workforce, D&I will continue to be and has to be such a huge focus moving forward. Now, another angle, if I could bring to it, is that, you know, a lot of I haven't got any specific data on this, but we've seen employee engagement also drop off in recent years. Now, diversity and inclusion plays a key part. Often when we talk D&I, you know, gender has a place in D&I. Yes, it's one puzzle piece within the overall D&I puzzle, if you will. But it's about diversity, equity, and inclusion is about more than just gender. It's about diversity in age, diversity in thinking, diversity in expertise. So I truly think as we look forward, we have to move away from DEI becoming just a centralized silo function. So yes, there's a space for those CDO exec roles and DEI function as such. But for us to be truly effective in delivering the value that we want to of diversity, the best way I think that we can unlock that is by really embedding it into the organization. So similar to what you just said, Bronwyn, we are starting to see organizations move towards embedding DEI as a part of the scorecards for each of the business leads. So, you know, for lack of, as an example, VPs of specific business functions now having DEI as a scorecard, that as a metric within their scorecard that they get measured against, they get monitored against, and that they can put in specific measures for to drive more of that thinking for their own specific business units. So the more that it's embedded into the way that we think and operate, that's truly the way that I think we're going to drive more focus on here. So DEI, even though we might not have those specific siloed roles as they used to be, used to exist, the more that we can embed them in organizations. And I think this, we're starting to see this happen a lot more as well. The more they're embedded in the way that we think organically, that truly has got to be the way forward.
And thankfully, we're starting to see that. And I've certainly seen with my VP that she's got diversity targets on her scorecard. What we are often criticised for as an energy industry is that we're working on the D, but we're not so great at the I, in that we're not being as inclusive with the diversity. And you know, it might be one step at a time, but I think focusing on what would that I look like and how can we embed the I into our organisations is important. Did anybody want to challenge that? How are we all going with the eye?
I was thinking about this as Rosemary was actually commenting on the previous trend, right? I think the eye is also very challenging in the new workplace of the future as everyone starts working remotely, with the flexibility that that human interaction, that the way of collaborating becomes a little bit more challenging. But you're right, it's a tricky question, Bronwyn, on how do we drive more of that inclusion?
And for me, it's inclusion in decision making. So how do we make sure we have those diverse voices at the table when we make those decisions? And, you know, how do we bring those voices that might not necessarily be at currently at the table forward, and how do we bring younger or ethnically diverse or disabled voices to the fore?
I think in my professional experience, I think the I part is very important if we can drive it within the team, in particular within the organization. We do it top down, the leadership team will really need to drive that to include as much as possible your diverse workforce, and also provide the opportunity for the younger workforce and across different diversity crew to have a voice on the table. So I think leadership team will play a very big part in the I part. And also in the workforce itself, the team members, I think as part of the team members, we need to feel that, you know, we need to contribute. If we have a voice, we need to voice it out. I think we need to recognize our value in our voice, like giving voice to value. And I think that is something that is important to be included.
Sorry, I'm jumping in, Bronwyn, because I think there is a bit of an elephant that we're not naming here.
Oh, gosh, I love a good elephant. Go for it.
Good elephant is, what is the depth of the talent pool or just of the pool for gender diversity or diversity in general in the energy sector? So I think that there is a very real challenge. And if I talk for myself, being in a position of having to try to foster, you know, diversity and inclusion for some workforce where essentially the talent pool is a male talent pool, this is extremely challenging. And Aki, I really love the KPIs and the metrics and the dashboard. If it doesn't get measured, there is no focus, there is no action, so we need that. The challenge is that the three-year horizon is not enough. Like, I think there is a need for the industry to have a really long-term strategy about how we bring more diversity into the jobs of the future that we need so that we can truly build that diversity over time.
I think that's exactly it. And a lot of conversation has been going on in Australia and particularly in DQ, which is the department involved in energy, are really around what is that skills uplift that we want to see and what are those competencies that we want to see and are we going to see lots of new fresh faces and talent coming from other industries into the energy industry. So are we going to see lots of technology-based you know, AI, you know, machine learning graduates, are we going to see them from different perspectives and come in and give that freshness and that new skill uplift? And it's such an exciting area for us to have a think about. And I think we can, I think if you are an avid listener of Focus on Utilities, we're going to be dealing with that issue in a new podcast coming up after this one. So keep on top of it. The next topic that we have is one that I love, which is 4-day work weeks will move from radical to routine. I haven't worked a 5-day work week since I had my children, so it'd be nice to be the norm, really. I think, Vanessa, you've worked 4 days a week for quite some time too. How have you found it?
Well, I must say, when we've been talking about work-life balance for decades for now, and it is good to see how it's being implemented. Personally, ever since that I've been a full-time employee, 5 days a week is the norm for me, not knowing any better. Recently, I have the opportunity to reduce and reassess the way I work. So I reduced my working hours to 4.5 days, not quite a 4 days, thanks to my current employer. I've underestimated that, you know, having that additional personal time post-work week is so important. I feel so much different. I feel lighter. I feel happier, in particular in my mental well-being. So research has shown that the correlation between mental well-being at workplace has a direct impact on productivity and efficiency. There's 36% increase in revenue, 63% felt easier to attract talent. Now, this is over 50% of possibly positive feedback, in particular in the current market that is experiencing skills and talent shortage. 2/3 of Australians believe working 5 days a week could soon be a thing in the past. Medibank is doing a trial for 6 months. Bunnings implemented 4 days a week earlier this year. I just can't wait to see the results.
Do you reckon I'll get somebody to help me with my, you know, hammer? And all my era. They'll be happier, which will be great. But I love Bunnings, or otherwise known as Hammer Barn. But what I think is such a difference looking at the 4-day week is how much the unions have tried to put it into various requirements and what we're probably seeing is more than just we would love to do it, it's becoming a real thing. And will we see that normalisation happen? I'm not quite sure, but, you know, really, when I worked on a trading floor only a few years ago, we moved our Friday night drinks to Thursday night. So I think that was the first sign to me that potentially we weren't all as switched on a Friday as we thought we were. I don't know. What we could see then is how the labour market dynamics are really changing what employees are asking for from their employers. Is that how you also see it, Vanessa?
I think, well, back to the earlier trend, it's about the flexibility in the workplace as well, encouraging the employees to take up the flexibility, at the same time also be responsible in what you contribute to the organisation. So having that 4 days week increase your productivity and efficiency. So why not? If that is something that, you know, you could bring to the table. And when we talk about 4 days week, it's not necessary that, you know, there is a flexibility in it. It's not necessary Monday to Thursday. It could be Tuesday to Friday, depending on your personal circumstances and professional needs. So Aki, I understand that you've been doing 4 days week in the past couple of years now. What is your experience?
Yes, I have. So quite similar to Bronwyn, I and yourself, actually, I didn't know any different. I used to work a normal full-time five-day week until I had the kids. And then ever since I've come back, it's been I've been working 4 days. And, you know, I won't lie, I agree that extra day or that extra half day of being able to, it's not quite time on your own, but having that mind space to think, to reflect, at times, it actually only helps me. It definitely helps my well-being. I feel a little bit more in control, and I find it helps me be a bit more structured and focused when I am at work. Again, quite similar to my earlier point, I think as we transition towards a four-day week, we've just, as an industry and as organizations, we've just got to be mindful that, again, how do I put this, that we don't lead to that there are people not rushing towards a burnout situation, because that can also happen, right? So your roles are in imbalance with the flexibility that a four-day work week offers you.
I think that's right, Aki. I love your thoughts on, by compressing your week from 5 to 4 days, does that then lead to things like burnout, because you're not having those breaks? You're trying to concentrate your work within a smaller amount of time. Like, I always thought when I was working 4 days a week, finding a toilet break was like the ultimate game of Tetris. Like, you're just trying to squeeze it in somewhere. You know, what do we, like, from the three of you ladies, like, how have you found sort of that compressed working, and is it creating other demands in ways that you didn't think it would?
Maybe, Bronwyn, I'm a big fan of flexible and part-time working arrangement. I'm going to start by stating that. However, I'm not a big fan of a mandate for 4 days. Because if I look at my experience over the last 10 years, I don't think I've kept the same flexible part-time working arrangement for more than 18 months at a time. Because I think that one of the key for successful part-time or flexible working arrangement is actually to adapt to the situation, to adapt to your work situation, to adapt to your family situation, and the needs are changing. The needs that you have when you actually need to do the drop-off and the pickup are different from the needs that you have when you, maybe your kids are, you know, older. The needs that you have are different if you're a single mother or if you live in a partnership. You know, suddenly your work schedule is changing. So for me, it's really important that we keep in mind that flexibility in all the sense. And it might not be 4 days a week. It may look like something different. And the link to the burnout is that, from my experience, 4 days a week, there were some people, they take Friday off. They rush to the first day. Like, they try to compress everything to the first day. They end up being out of cycle with the natural cycle of the organization. And there is that compression, which is not really good and maybe doesn't serve them or feed them. So my big call out is, can we really take a deep look at what is working for the organization, what is working to the employee, and in the mindset of diversity and inclusion, to keep in mind that it might not be a one-size-fits-all.
Well, that's a really good point, Rosemary. If I could, sorry, Bronwyn, I just jumped in. I was just trying to say this. If we take an example from, over the last few years, I've often heard of women, when they come back from maternity leave, they'll come back to a full-time role. However, they'll agree to coming back on a four-day basis but deliver the full-time role. And often what we see is then they're spending 10, 12 hours per day compressing that work. And again, then we're just fast-tracking them onto burnout, right? So if there's some learnings that we can adapt from there to as we look towards transitioning to a four-day work week, taking into consideration that that we are not overwhelming people with the roles that they have to deliver within the time period that they have. I think that there's some further thinking for us to do there still.
I completely agree. Like Rosemary was mentioning before, it's not one size fits all. I think everyone has different personal circumstances. So like you say, compressing 5 days' work into 4 days, that could be a horrible experience. But for different individuals, if they are having some time off themselves, let's say 3 days of the weekend, and when they come back on Monday, they are fully recharged, they're able to focus better, their efficiency goes up, productivity goes up. So I think that 4 days' work week works really well for that particular individual. So I think the industry or the organization needs to look at how we can implement this just so that it works well and flow through the whole organization, depending on the professional needs, the personal needs, and we can all work cohesive together in order to make that happen.
And I think that is a good way to think about, and it really comes through in our next trend, which is around traditional stereotypes of career paths are really going to change. And we've seen that over the last couple of years. But what we're going to see is new ways that people will run their careers. And this will change because of the labour market tightening. And what we've seen is that I don't think this is going to change with the energy industry. You know, the scenarios are that clean energy jobs, you know, this is the IEA, will increase by 8 million by 2030, with fossil fuel careers declining by 2.5 million, which is a net increase of 5.7 million jobs globally. So we're going to see that tight labour market continue. And in doing so, we're going to see lots of employees decide potentially that they don't want to work until they retire at the peak of their careers at 65. You know, this might be something different and something they want to explore. And this was brought up in a LinkedIn survey that I came across in 2022 of 23,000 workers globally. And they found that 62% had already taken a career break and 35% would like to take one in the future. So that 35% was me, because I'm on one too. But maybe, Vanessa, you can sort of tell us about how your career has changed and how you've been seeing this change in career path.
I had a mini career break when I moved country. So just to give you a little bit of background, I'm an engineer, so I used to work on site, so doing a lot of engineering design, site commissioning, that sort of work. And then there was an opportunity for me to go overseas on an expatriate role for a number of years. During that expatriate role, same thing, there's no hybrid situation, that client pay for you and you expect to show up every day. So decided to come back to Australia after a few years outside of Australia. That is when I decided to go on a little break before I embarked into a new workforce in Australia. That is when I experienced the difference, having a career break and giving me a transition, moving from a full-time on-site type of role into a more office-based desktop. That is when I realized that having the courage, being open-minded to new opportunity, willing to try new things is so important. So that's my little experience in transitioning from a typical site role to a office-based role. I think since returning to Australia, things has been great. So I think the key learnings from my side is there's twofold in the transition. The first one, a job seeker. For example, myself, when I was transitioned from expatriate into Australia, being open-minded and willing to try new things, give yourself an opportunity, back yourself. You'll be surprised what you are capable of. Secondly, employers need to look out for a different type of experience. For example, look outside the box for a traditional career experience. Understanding the benefits of skill transfer, giving employees or newcomers an opportunity, because having a different experience is not just going to promote the benefit of organization. It also brings in innovation where the traditional way of doing things. So I think it's been great. What do you think, Rosemary?
Yeah, as you were talking, I was reflecting on career breaks are fantastic, you know, to reload, to recharge, to think about the future. And career transition can be great as well for people who seek renewal and change and, you know, explore different avenues for themselves. But I'm just wondering whether in this industry, whether there is actually support for that diversity of career, for inviting people with different background, different skill set into the energy, into the power industry. And I think it's challenging. It's challenging for an industry which has a lot of risk associated with it, like risk safety is absolutely critical. And to some extent, the mission of this industry is to keep the light on. So what is the risk appetite to some extent of this industry to welcome and to integrate the diversity of experience that is incredibly valuable, but that may get us onto, you know, a more risky position? And I think the challenge is this is going to be an absolute legitimate aspiration, especially under the younger generation. So how do you adjust the value proposition that you have with the risk that you need to manage, with the expectation of people for having diversity of career path? So I'm not providing answers. I'm just asking, you know, some of the challenges that this industry, I think, is facing.
I think one of the ways that we can really look at it in the energy industry is to not be so fixed on traditional expertise, but really, you know, grabbing it where we can. You know, finding ways for people with fossil fuel careers to move into clean energy careers and back again, and facilitating that, having understanding of standards and certifications for engineers and operators where they can very quickly move from industry to industry and really start to see where they can move and quickly upskill and retool. And I think having that flexibility and having the Australian government support that is really important. I think that's going to be what we might see. I think that's what we're going to see in the Australian Energy Employment Report that's going to come out hopefully this year, is like, how can we find those new pools of career workers and how do we bring them into the industry and upskill them fairly quickly? The other way I would really love to see, and it's happening more in the finance industry than it is in the energy industry, is for organisations to deliberately make it easier for their talent to come back. So, you know, there used to be the old adage, you know, if you work for an IOC or an NOC, once you left, that was it. You know, you don't come back. Now, that's really changed over the years, but I think this notion that once you leave the industry, there is no way back should be gone. You know, if you have the skills and the talent and you want to come back, you know, organisations should find a way to help you do that. And that's, you know, simple. It's a person that you know. It's a person that you have traditionally worked with that has the skills and the experience to make something work. So that's looking like things called mid-career leave programs and returnships. So I'd love to see a couple of them come up.
Fantastic.
And I think we've just got to ask our energy companies to have us back.
You mentioned about the flexibility of skill set and flexibility of workforce coming back. You know, when we talk about diversity, apart from diversity in gender, diversity in culture background, there is diversity in skill set and experience as well. How do we able to transfer all this diversity into the workforce and fully utilize them to their 100% potential? I think that is the key things the industry should really look into.
And to be honest, it's important that we do, right? Because if you look at what the research is showing at the moment, new grads coming out of university now, so some of our early careers and early talent, they're expected to have 5 to 7 career changes in their lifetime. You know, at least 12 jobs that are completely different to the traditional way of working of past years. So it's a really good question on how do we cater to that appetite of wanting, you know, of keeping it interesting and keeping it diverse, yet at the same time make sure that we're delivering to the needs of the sector, because it's true, the energy sector, and I'll speak perhaps for the world that I come from, you know, from the grid technology and grid maintenance, grid operation, that can be quite a conservative space, because you are ensuring reliability, because you are, like Rosemary said, your core responsibility is to keep the lights on. So often that portfolio career versus depth of a career conversation becomes very interesting, and how do we facilitate that, keeping in mind what the future and the next wave of talent is looking for as well. It's a really interesting conversation.
All right, and you didn't think we could have a conversation about the future of the workforce without talking about generative AI, of course. And that's certainly what is on most of our tongues when we're talking about what does the workforce look like in the future. So I have this notion that we are way up the hill of hype when it comes to generative AI. And certainly a lot of the critics are saying, well, we're now entering the trough of disillusionment for the next 2 to 5 years in how AI is going to affect how we work in the workplace. And I don't dispute that. I'd love to hear anybody who doesn't. But certainly what we've seen is that there are significant benefits, and certainly a study that's come out even last month really looked at how the power sector is using AI, and it came back with 86% of power professionals are optimistic about the future of AI, and they expect it to allow them to spend more time with their friends and family. 30% of the power industry already uses AI as part of their everyday, and a further 12% are expecting to adopt it within 6 months. Now, I'm not particularly surprised about this. Like, I think for many, many years, I've been keeping an eye on machine learning and how we're going to involve, you know, lots of large, big data sets and how they will do a lot of things that AI has done to help us, you know, with our operations. And so I'm not particularly surprised. You know, Aki, are you particularly surprised that people we've already integrated AI into our everyday tasks in this industry?
No, not really, Bronwyn, but I do tend to agree with your notion of us being well up the hype creek on this one. I think AI is a big buzzword in the industry, and arguably I would put it forward that we're not everyone is on the same page when we're talking about AI, and nor do we truly understand how to unlock the full potential of it. I think, and forgive me, the common understanding of AI tends to be around, you know, ChatGPT and how can we make use of those AI tools, but machine learning and you know, getting the most out of big data, and how do we convert it into, you know, analytics that give you better insights? That's been kind of come that's been built into technology as it progresses for quite a while. In fact, that's kind of the core of what we do at Schneider here. But I do think there is more coming. And I believe there is a podcast that we're going to be working on as a part of the Power and Utilities podcast series. But I think there is still more of a discussion for us to have in terms of how AI can truly impact everyday lives of people. But when it comes to big technology, how our technology is evolving in terms of solutions that we're deploying out in the field and systems that we're deploying out in the field, absolutely, AI has been progressively playing a big part.
And I think one already. Thing is, yeah, exactly. And I think one thing we'll see is the need for technical skill uplift. And we'll see more and different types of skills coming into the energy industry. You know, a recent study showed that of HR recruiters found that 24% anticipated there'll be a greater demand for cybersecurity and robotic skills that will help influence how our operations work. And they're seeing a potential skill shortage in this area, and that certainly is not the traditional area I thought we would need our energy sector industry to be growing in, but certainly that's an area. Rosemary?
Yeah, no, Brenwyn, you mentioned that 6%, did I get this right, of employees in the energy sector are optimistic about AI?
86%. It's quite a number.
86%. Quite a number. I think that's absolutely huge.
And I think it is because we've been working with it for so long. And it's not something that we've seen, you know, sort of pop up within the first quarter of last year. It really is something we've been seeing a move. I was blown away by digital twins, you know, just a couple of years ago. And I think that's where we're going to see. And I think if you're really very interested, the Power and Utilities Australia conference is coming up, and there is a special section on how we're seeing AI really work into the future of the energy industry. So I'm certainly going to be there for that one. It's really something I find almost mind-blowing. But I think that's the end of our trends. I've certainly really enjoyed this conversation, and I've really enjoyed the personal stories that have come out of this. So thank you to all of you for sharing and opening up. It's very difficult to be vulnerable and to really show us what it's like to work in flexible environments as well as balancing that need for family and work. So thank you so much, and I'm hoping the audience has really enjoyed it, and that we'll see you back for the next podcast. And I'm going to send you over to Paul.
Well, as promised, that really was a cracker. Thanks to our guests, Vanessa, Rosemary and Aki, and special thanks to Bronwyn, who has proven a case to replace me as our regular host. Be sure to join us again in April for our next episode, talking all things cybersecurity, presented by Akamai. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you again soon.